Tori Van Oot is just an absolutely exceptional journalist. One of the better ones you're going to find here in Minneapolis-St. Paul for sure. She's got a new gig. She is with the Axios Twin Cities newsletter. She'll be kind enough to explain what that's going to curtail. And she's going to join us right now to talk about some of the news items happening in Minneapolis-St. Paul. Hi, Tori.
Hi, happy Friday.
Happy
Sounds like a great program you have with on your breakthrough you're just talking about. I'm going to have to listen to those interviews.
Well, we let's face it. 2 weeks of me doing best of, that just doesn't exist. I mean, there's not enough best of there. But I always had all these authors. And so, you know, we'll get the bunch of books in and I found the best ones. We do some great interviews. We're looking forward to that. You have, of course, people know that you wrote for the Star Tribune and you've been in town for a while here, but Axios is expanding their footprint here in Minneapolis-St. Paul, right?
We are. So Axios is launching a Twin Cities newsletter in January. We launch on January 25th. Our goal in a nutshell is to help you get smarter faster about the biggest stories unfolding here in the Twin Cities, everything from politics, which I've covered for a while, to business, to city issues, tech, crime, all of this. And so you can sign up at axios.com/local. And we'll just deliver you a mix of original reporting and point you to some of the best reporting by my stellar colleagues here in the Twin Cities media ecosystem. So it should be a lot of fun.
We need you right now. For this reason, we need you right now. We lost City Pages, Southwest Journal's gone. You know, media is coming under a new assault here, and so you know there are some bright spots that are coming back here. You going for Axios? I think that's a wonderful idea. Congratulations on that.
Oh, thanks, and we hope it's fun. And you know, you look it up when you get an email. They come from me, and you can always readers can reach out, tell me what they're hearing. We want to engage and be interactive. Tell us what you want to hear about, right? Because you're right that there's a lot of really great reporting here in the Twin Cities, but we have had some big losses, too. Some local food and beverage publications, things like that, too. So, you know, the more eyes and ears we have out there to help cover these cities, the better.
You and I can start our own coffee house review.
We'll do that.
I like that idea.
Yeah.
Let's talk a little bit about two of the bigger news stories that are going on. First of all, I want to focus on what has happened with Minnesota Reformer. Sahan Journal as well has waded in on this, as well as now some other news outlets. The Minneapolis Police Department, obviously police go through, you know, when they go through complaints against them, there's a review process. Sometimes there's an actual, you know, arbitrator that comes on in. Starting with the Minnesota Reformer, they went and asked for, through a Freedom of Information request, the records of these disciplinary actions against Minneapolis Police Department. The city fought them, and it wasn't until they got a lawyer involved that they got these documents, and now you can see why. To say the very least, these disciplinary records that the Minnesota Reformer first got, as well as some of the other news outlets, they do not paint a very good picture of the disciplinary, you know, people getting, you know, some sort of solace or result when police officers, you know, do cross that line. I mean, there are some ugly stories here.
Yeah, so the Reformer, you know, we already knew that officer discipline and officer discipline policy has kind of been a flashpoint in this ongoing debate about police accountability, right? But what the Reformer found, as you mentioned, Tony and Max, I mean, some folks should go read this full story on the Minnesota Reformer's website, but, you know, they got this trove of documents, of disciplinary files that hadn't been released to the public before. They found that just less than 3% of the complaints of misconduct during this, I think it was like a six-year period, resulted in any disciplinary action at all. But what's more, as you mentioned, some of these files lay out pretty troubling allegations, sometimes patterns of troubling behavior. There's a follow-up story today on an officer who had multiple instances involving allegedly kicking people in the face. But they also found that the department was really slow to address the abuse, which was another more structural potential issue that the investigation uncovered here. So not only are these, actions allegedly happening, or officers are being accused of taking this misconduct, problematic behavior, but that the city's been and the department has been pretty slow during this time period to address it.
Well, and I mean, is it fair to say, is it slow, or is, I mean, clearly, when you look at the story that was in the Sahan Journal, where you have an officer making so irresponsible and unacceptable racial comments to Somali teens in Minneapolis, and the efforts by that officer to cover up his tracks, only if not for other officers from the park department showing up and there being tape of it, that you would probably nothing happen there. But even when all this came to light and all this was out there and the arbitrator knew, the city knew, people were trying to fire this guy, the union themselves was still saying, no, this guy deserves to keep his job. It's not so much, I think it's kind of a cover-up. It's just they know that there are officers who are there, and the union stance has seems to be, we don't care, we want them on the force.
Yeah, I mean, the Reformers investigation did seem to show that, sometimes at the end of these investigations, it's like a letter of reprimand or something, right, without more serious corrective actions or kind of retraining and that sort of things. And, you know, they did, I think the Reformer writes about what they call, you know, leaders being blind to numerous warning signs or managers unaware of subordinates being investigated, right? And so, they did raise a lot of questions about how this misconduct is treated and what's actually being done about it.
One of the other things that this story pointed out, and I think this is very interesting, is there just does seem to be giving them the benefit of the doubt, there seems to be a very, clear lack of communication, because one of the things that happens is as these officers are going through disciplinary hearings, and some of them for very serious, let's call it crimes, the reality is they're getting their commendations, they're getting letters of review in their record that are being used then to defend the police officer. Mm-hmm. So, I'm not quite sure if it's a case where is it more of a cover-up, or is it really you have a disciplinary action going on? Meanwhile, the same officer, because that disciplinary action is not known to the management or the other people, is getting accolades, and henceforth the accolades seem to offset the disciplinary problems and people seem to walk away. I mean, there is an interesting problem there that I definitely think needs to be addressed.
Yeah, there's a lot of questions raised by this investigation. Again, I'd really encourage folks to read it. Like you mentioned, some of the Minnesota Reformer, most of it, the Sahan Journal published the story about the officer who, said same as, I think, Somali youth in that case. But we'll have to see. We'll have to see how the city responds, right? We've already had a number of council members, speak out saying they're very disturbed by some of these issues with the discipline process that the article raises. And the mayor, I think just today, said he's read it, he's doing a deep dive. We'll have to see what comes of it.
Tori, do you know, of your knowledge of police departments, not just here, are you aware of any police departments in a major city where the, disciplinary review is a very public element? Because that's the other issue here, is that there definitely is a lot of people, this is years after these disciplinary hearings have happened, we're finally finding out about them. Are there any cities, to your knowledge, where disciplinary actions like this are actually a public record as they happen?
Good question. That's not something that I have covered or looked at, and I don't recall seeing that in the Reformers reporting. But that's another kind of element of this whole story, is the fact that, there hasn't been, and some journalists and experts and critics have said that there haven't, there just hasn't been enough oversight or transparency about all of this in the past. I think open government kind of transparency advocates would see the very fact that these documents were obtained as a bit of a win in that department, right? That the information is out there. Because again, as we talked about at the beginning here, the Reformer, Tony Webster, journalist, had requested these documents and faced resistance and ultimately won in getting them released to the public. So, but that's a great question. I don't know if you've heard of any, but I'm not sure about that.
Yeah, I don't know. Is this really a Minneapolis Police Department problem, or does no police department? I know Chicago doesn't. I know Philadelphia doesn't. Mm-hmm. And so, does no police department in a major city allow disciplinary actions and hearings to be a public record, that you have to find out what happened with Freedom of Information requests?
That's an interesting question. Yeah, I mean, I know that police discipline policies and measures are an issue in obviously cities beyond Minneapolis, but that's an interesting question. I'm not sure about that.
Tori Van Oot joining us, Axios's Twin Cities newsletter. Let's focus now on the other story that's gotten a lot of traction. This group came on out, Reopen Minnesota. They said they were going to they started making rumblings last week. This week they said we're reopening. They said they had 150 business and in a very Canadian girlfriend manner said they had another 221 anonymous businesses who are also going to open up and disregard the governor's pandemic emergency dining enclosure rules. The there have been some businesses that have opened up, not nearly as many as Reopen said we're going to. And the state's response is very stark that they're going to take these people's liquor licenses and they're going to shut them down one way or the other. Starting off with the businesses, I know there are a lot of businesses that are frustrated, but I think there was a lot more bravado that this was a much larger group of people. And in perspective, the Mall of America has 520 stores, I think it is, and the Mall of America is 520. This is, you know, a third less than that. You know, even at with their anonymous numbers, it seems like this is more of a small group of very loud business owners as opposed to a larger percentage of the business owners statewide.
Yeah, as you mentioned, you know, we don't know exactly how many restaurants are opening or have opened. You know, this group has been talking about their numbers. And as you also mentioned, you know, some have been anonymous. Some folks who have signed on to the petition seem to be businesses that were open anyway and had was showing support, and some have since said, no, we're actually not going to open. We were just trying to make a point. But some have opened their doors. And as you mentioned, they've had consequences already for it. Alibi, a bar in Lakeville, folks might have seen the photos on the news or on Twitter. You know, people crammed in together, elbow to elbow, drinking beers, no masks, cheering, you know, big crowds, the exact kind of crowds that public health officials are kind of discouraging through these different measures, including social distancing and these temporary closures. And as you mentioned, yeah, the state has suspended the liquor license, as they said they would, for some of these businesses. I believe Attorney General Ellison has filed lawsuits against Alibi and I believe one other restaurant at this point.
Neighbors by the Rum in Princeton, yeah.
Yep. And you know, has said, in one case, I believe there was a kind of a restraining order filed forcing them to close. And, you know, these restaurant owners say that, I think the neighbor's owner said to the Star Tribune that they were just trying to do what's best for their employees. But these are real consequences. You know, mm-hmm. If you lose your liquor license as a restaurant, you're not going to be able to do anything for your employees when restaurants do open up again.
Yeah,
they've smacked some of the openings down, but some are vowing to keep reopening. So we'll see what happens there.
Well, the Princeton one had said that he did it the one day, and he seems to have been scared back by the attorney general's in realizing that I'm only doing this to try to get tips for my employees, which you know Robin Hood theme aside, you know you're still endangering people. When you go back to the Alibi Bar in Lakeville, the thing which is amazing to me is that up until they opened, all these – this Reopen Minnesota said, we're safe, we're clean, we'll follow rules, we'll follow regulations. And the fact that – you're right, those images came on out. I think one of the things that turned off public perception quite a bit is that it's one thing if you had a picture of people sitting socially distanced apart, everyone wearing a face mask, you know, helping out the bar. It didn't help your cause when it looks like a South Dakota rodeo in there. And you basically have no one wearing face masks, no one social distancing, and this just not being about opening the business but thumbing their nose at the governor. Yeah. I don't know if that helped their cause at all.
Yeah, I don't know. I guess it depends on who who you ask. But and I would say that, you know, this pause that we're in right now, as Walt has called a pause to shut down, you know, he announced this week that indoor dining will be closed through the beginning of January through the holidays, which, you know, a lot of restaurants and bars are saying is going to be really, really difficult for them financially. Though outdoor restaurant service can resume for those brave enough to brave the cold. And I will say that on the flip side, there are a number of restaurants and bars that are kind of getting creative within the limits that the government has set, you know, that the Governor Walz has set, and, you know, trying to do the best of what they can with these limitations. And I know, I think I saw a brewery in Northeast talking about, as the temperature drops, so will the pint prices. I know, saw something about Gnome Pub in St. Paul kind of screening movies in the parking lot. So you can sit in, like, a drive-in and eat in your car. You know, so this is a really difficult time. I think it's important to not underestimate that this is a really difficult time for the restaurant and hospitality industry. They've lost, but places are closing, they've lost jobs, but there are also a lot of restaurants trying to, you know, work within, lobby the government to reopen, or allow them for some partial reopening, but also work within the system we have now.
Well, and you bring up, you know, trying to find ways to get around the rules. I remember when they outlawed smoking in the building, unless it was a performance piece, and some bars considered themselves, tried to relabel themselves a theater. And so people could smoke inside the bar still. The one thing that there is an element here that, I mean, it's, you know, kind of the buyer beware sort of thing. For the people that are going to try to thumb their nose at the rules and try to open up, we had a caller call in yesterday, and this is indeed true. Insurance companies can deny your insurance immediately if you break the law. And so and you know, most insurance companies will do that. So I don't know if that's being, you know, they understand the full consequences that, you know, the attorney general and the state might pull back, even, I don't think they will, but they might pull back on their charges. At the end of the day, though, they still could end a very big problem if they can't find someone that's going to insure their business. Then they definitely have to shut down.
That's an interesting question. Yeah, that's definitely a consideration or complication that these businesses could face. And again, the kind of potential consequences from the state's actions, what they're able to do, you know, like whether it's a lawsuit or a liquor license suspension, you know, those are significant too for businesses. You're right. We'll see what AG Ellison will do, how far this will go. Another kind of political element here to watch is that the Senate Republicans have kind of threatened to cut the Attorney General's funding if he continues to find these businesses in the budget discussions ahead. So I don't think, even if these few restaurants close down for the shutdown, I don't think this is the last we'll hear of this.
Oh, no. I'm pretty sure you and we've already seen
a lot about it.
We see the playing board laying out in front of us for the next 2 years for sure. Tori Van Oot, I want to make sure, once again, we're going to get the links out for Axios, how you can sign up. That comes up. What's the date that the newsletter kicks off for Axios?
Our kickoff date is January 25th, but you can sign up now so you don't miss it. It's going to be a lot of fun. All the news you need to know about the Twin Cities without wasting your time. We'll keep it brief and we'll keep it smart and we'll keep it the facts.
All right, I'm already signed up. You should get signed up as well here. January 25th, Axios, the new Twin Cities newsletter with Tori Van Oot. Tori, thank you very much. We'll look forward to having you back on the air here come January, okay?
Thanks. Have a great, happy holidays, everyone.
Happy holidays to you as well. Tori Van Oot joining us.